Driving home from a conference on Wednesday evening, I listened to a profile of the British tennis player Johanna Konta. I confess I knew virtually nothing about her before I listened to the profile, and if I'm really honest, not a lot more afterwards, for she's an intensely private person. But one thing came through really clearly. There was nothing in her game to separate her from the rest. She didn't have a better serve than anyone else. She didn't have such devastating ground strokes that it was obvious from a very young age that she would succeed. What distinguished her, and something that all her coaches mentioned, was her devotion to her craft, her devotion to training, her devotion to asking questions about how to improve, her devotion to facing the truth about herself, her devotion to finding ways to get better. As a junior, she was never the best in her age group. She never rose higher than number 11 in the world in her age group. As a professional, she's twice known 2-year plateaus in her career where her world ranking barely shifted. Between the end of 2009 and 2011, she moved up just 55 places from 360 to 305 in the world. Between the end of 2012 and the end of 2014, her ranking only improved 3 places, from 153 to 150. Most observers then thought that she had found her level and she would rise no higher. Others would have been discouraged, others would have accepted their lot and maybe found other things to focus on. But Konta's devotion to training, to fitness, to practice, her devotion to improving never wavered. And realizing that she had a mental block, she was never able to play her best tennis when it really mattered, she worked with a mental coach to improve how she approached those crucial moments. And the improvement was dramatic. If she improved just 3 places in the 2 years to the end of 2014, in the 2 years to the end of 2016, her ranking improved from 150 to 10. She's now ranked 7 in the world, and that will improve after Wimbledon because she's done much better this week than she's ever done before. Her devotion has shaped her life. When many observers have doubted whether she could improve, questioned whether she'd reached her level, Konta has refused to be deterred. When the LTA cut her funding, she found other cheaper ways to keep working at her craft. Her devotion has shaped her life. In our reading today, we see the effect of devotion in the early church. The same word is used in Acts 1:14, Acts 2:42, and Acts 2:46. It's translated devoted only in verse 42, but it's the same word in all 3 verses. And very unusually, I woke up one morning this week with this word in my mind, with this word in the Greek in my mind, which I think has never happened before. And that prompted me to change our reading today and the direction of the sermon. The word used means to devote yourself. It means to continue steadfastly in something, which is why Johanna Konta comes to mind, for she shows us that determination to continue steadfastly in something. So I want to talk this morning about how our devotion to God and to one another should shape our lives. But there's another point that needs to be made first. If you look at Acts 2, if you've got that in front of you in the Bibles, if you look at Acts 2, particularly verses 41 and 42 in the Bibles, they are firmly separated by a chapter heading. Trouble is that chapter heading is not there in the Greek text. There is no firm division between verse 41 and verse 42. It's just a semicolon in the Greek. The full stop comes at the end of verse 42. Why on earth does that matter, you're thinking? Well, simply because verse 42 flows as a response to verse 41. Literally, those welcoming his word were baptized, And as a consequence of the word which they'd welcomed, the word of the gospel, they then devoted themselves in the ways verse 42 describes. Their devotion is a consequence. It's a response flowing from all that God has done for us in Jesus Christ. In fact, we've got to say that their devotion was kindled by his devotion. Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost is all about how God in Jesus has sought us and saved us. Such is the devotion of Jesus Christ to his people. Such is his devotion even to those who don't yet know him, to those who may choose never to know him. Such is the devotion of Jesus Christ to his people that he embraced the cross. Why? To give us the right to know God the Father for ourselves. So we're not like Johanna Konter, searching and reaching for something for ourselves, for a worldly glory and a wealth in this life. We are responding to someone searching and reaching for us. We're responding to a devotion and a passion that drove Jesus to humble himself and seek us, that drove Jesus to his knees before his disciples washing their feet, drove Jesus to his knees in Gethsemane, longing that there might be another way, and yet the devotion that still drove Jesus beyond Gethsemane to the cross. The devotion we see described in Acts, whether it's the devotion of the early church gathered in prayer, waiting to be clothed with power from on high, whether it's the devotion of the early church to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, the devotion of the early church to breaking of bread and to the prayers, the devotion we'd see described in Acts is a response, it's a surrender, it's a pursuit kindled in us by the devotion of Jesus. That's what comes first. We have been sought, therefore we're seeking. We have been loved and passionately pursued, so we're devoting ourselves in return. We've been purchased with sacrificial love, so we are shaping our lives to respond in the same spirit to his devotion. None of this makes sense without his love. We love, as 1 John 4:19 reminds us, we love because he first loved us. If that doesn't make sense to you yet, then please begin by asking God to reveal the full extent of his love to you. For it's from that experience everything else flows. We love because he first loved us. I'm going to suggest three ways we might devote ourselves to God anew over coming months. Three ways our devotion to him might shape our lives. But please remember, it's not devotion to what, it's devotion to whom. These are ways we might shape our lives so that we can draw closer to Jesus. They're not ends in themselves. They're ways in which we shape our lives to express and to deepen our devotion to the Lord who has loved us from before the foundation of the world, whose devotion to us has made it possible for us to know God ourselves. First way to express our devotion to God: taking a Sabbath rest. Taking a Sabbath rest. We live in a crazily busy culture. Never have we tried to fit so much into our lives. There is little rest, little peace for most people these days. Even our smartphones, which make lives in some ways easier, also mean that we are hyper-connected and rarely, if ever, switch off. We're never off the grid. With social media and 24-hour news, misery reaches us in seconds from all around the world. We rarely, if ever, switch off. Now, I don't know about you, but I do quite a bit of running. If you run in the gym on the treadmill, the pace is unrelenting. It just keeps going, whether you're keeping up with it or not. You can struggle to stay on pace. The machine, not your body, sets the pace. But if you run on the road or on the common, there are natural variations based on how you're feeling, based on whether you are climbing or going downhill. Based on, frankly, if you've timed things so well that you have to wait for the pelican crossing. It's always a nice sneaky rest that you say, oh, I'm just going to slow down just so that I have to wait. If you're feeling the pace, you automatically back off a bit and recover. You keep going, but you ease the pace. Seems to me that so very many of us do life like we're running on a treadmill. We're not in charge of the rhythm. It makes no allowances for how we're feeling. We are simply trying to keep up with the pace. Not only is the pace unrelenting for many of us, for some of us it's also too fast. I was in Harrogate for a conference this week and I saw this bizarre situation where a young woman was on a treadmill in front of me, and what she was doing was setting the pace incredibly quickly. I think she was running about 16 kilometres an hour, which for me is very fast, very, very fast. She would just set it running and she would hold herself off and then sprint for 30 seconds and then go off again for 30 seconds. And sprint for 30 seconds and go off. It's a bizarre form of activity. I'm sure it's very, very effective in some ways. But she was setting a pace that she simply couldn't maintain for more than 30 seconds. We're not in charge of the rhythms of our lives. We make no allowances for how we're feeling. We simply try to keep up with the pace. There's a big difference when you're running or walking or cycling between the natural pace for you and one that's just too fast. There's a pace for all of us which, if you hit it, it feels like you're just going to carry on flowing along. Feels like you could keep it going for ages and ages. I remember years ago when I walked the Coast to Coast Walk, towards the end of the walk, I would walk for 5 hours without stopping, just because I was hitting that pace and it felt like it could go on forever and ever. And there's a pace for all of us which is just too fast, or maybe a lot too fast, and we are feeling it. We're struggling to hang on and keep going. How many of us know that easy, natural pace? How many of us are feeling it and just hanging on? Why do I mention all this? Simply because we are created to need rest. The word Sabbath, my commentary tells me, is taken from a Hebrew word meaning ceasing. It's supposed to be a ceasing from work. Exodus 20, 8 to 11, the Ten Commandments remind us that God himself ceased from work on the seventh day. That the work of creation ceased and that God himself rested. Not just rested, but that he blessed the Sabbath day. Blessed it, I think, with rest for his people. That rest was commanded for us. Commanded not just for us, but also for everyone in our families, everyone who serves us, even for our animals and everyone staying with us. Even the land was not to be worked. The Sabbath is supposed to be a ceasing from the relentless, just too quick to sustain pace of life, a time to rest, to recreate, to be with loved ones and to be with God. The early church kept the Sabbath. Yes, in the time of Jesus, it had become a crushing burden. It was full of regulations and rules. It had become joyless. What did Jesus do? He called the Sabbath back to its real purpose. He didn't decide he was never going to keep the Sabbath. He said this, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath," Mark 2, 27, 28. I have got the right, he was saying, to rule as to how the Sabbath should be kept. He called the Sabbath back to its original purpose, but he did not abolish it. The purpose of the Sabbath was to be a blessing, to be a gift of rest and recreation. It is made for us. For us to grow, for us to be restored, for us to be empowered. And note also that Jesus kept the Sabbath. It was always his practice to be in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He prioritized on a number of occasions, we see it in the Gospels, he prioritized rest, prayer, and fellowship with his disciples. He called them apart to rest. We need the Sabbath. We need the rest and the recreation, the restoration and the blessing that it offers. It is supposed to be a holiday every week. For those of us facing a pace of life that is simply unrelenting, for those of us struggling to hang on because the pace is too fast and we're struggling to hang on to it, we need the Sabbath. We need the divine wisdom that it represents. And you can't fit the Sabbath in as an extra burden. It has to be a conscious choice that you make as an individual or as a household, a conscious choice around which everything else has to fit. Because honestly, our experience recently has been it might mean working harder and smarter the rest of the week to carve out the time. But it promises a liberation and a renewal. Very many of us here would say that we are biblical people, that we seek to live our lives according to what the Bible teaches, and that this is one principle, one of the Ten Commandments, that even committed Christians regularly ignore today. And yet, with our mechanical, unrelenting, too full, too fast lives, we need it perhaps even more than ever before. So why not experiment with it over this coming summer holiday? I challenge you, I urge you to express your devotion to God this summer by seeking to find and keep his Sabbath rest. Second way I want to challenge you to express your devotion, set aside time for prayer. Acts 1:14 shows us 120 disciples of Jesus devoting themselves to prayer. Acts 2:42 shows us those who'd responded to the message of love from God devoting themselves to prayer. Acts 2:46 shows us that they did this daily, meeting together in one another's homes. Remember where we began? We love because he first loved us. What does our devotion amount to if it's not expressed regularly in our lives? If it's not woven into the very fabric of our daily lives in prayer, how real is our devotion to the Lord who loves us? I can tell you that I love my wife, but if I never talk to her, what does my claim amount to? If I never enjoy spending time with her, if we never do anything together, if we don't enjoy one another's company, then my words are just words. They're just wasted breath. The same is true of our relationship with God. Now, our conversations with our spouses and with our friends, they all happen in different ways and at different levels. They're not all the same kind of conversation. They don't all have the same intensity and depth. Some of them will just be chatting through the day. Some of them will be chatting about what we think God is doing or saying as we walk the dog. Sometimes we'll be wondering whether God is calling us to change direction. Sometimes we'll be listening carefully to one another because one of us is struggling. Some of them will just be laughing together. Some of them might be sitting in companionable silence. Likewise, not all of our prayerful conversations with God will be the same. They won't all have the same length, intensity, or depth. It doesn't always have to look and feel the same. But if we're devoted to God, prayer needs to be woven into the fabric of our daily lives. Now, for some of us, that might be in a really consistent way. The same time, the same place, even the same chair. But lots of us have lives that don't easily follow that kind of consistency because they are different from day to day. And if that's the case for you, timetable it in. Timetable in short chats, maybe when you're plugged in on the train or with worship songs on in the car. You can talk to God walking down the street. It used to be 20 years ago, if you walked down the street talking to yourself, everybody thought you were really, really strange. It passes for normal behavior now. You can talk aloud to God walking down the streets. As long as you've got headphones in, everybody will think you're just listening to music or talking to someone else. timetable in short chats when you're on the move, looking to see things to thank God for around you, but also timetable in longer chats, deeper chats when your day allows that, timetable in time for reflecting, for keeping a journal, for deeper prayer when your day allows that. Prayer should not be the same conversation over and over again. Like a healthy friendship or a marriage, it's lots of different conversations with different depths, lengths, intensities. But there is no real devotion to God where prayer does not get woven into the fabric of our lives. Our lives will be different in lots of ways. How can prayer be woven into the fabric of your life? Not every day do you need a deep heart-to-heart. Some days it might be just a brief chat, but prayer has got to be woven into the fabric of our lives. That's been the theme of this term. Trying to make prayer possible. Trying to bring it within reach. Trying to hear from different people within the church practically about how they pray. So we've had testimonies from members of the congregation. We've had a booklet of prayer testimonies from staff members. We're happy to reprint that if it would be helpful. We've seen that lots of people pray in different ways, all of which are valid and life-giving for those different people. So find ways that make sense for you and work within your daily life. You know the structure of your daily life. You know, or you can ask God to show you how prayer can be woven into your daily life. I don't know what those ways will be for you, but I do want to say, find them. Find them and use them. Weave them into your daily life. Don't have the summer off from prayer. What kind of a relationship do you have if you can go through 6 weeks without needing to have a conversation with that person? Just how valuable and significant is that relationship? There's no real devotion to God where prayer is not woven into the fabric of our lives, timetabled into our busy schedules, part of our lives. In what ways are you going to weave prayer into the fabric of your daily life? Third way in which to express our devotion, committing to small group community. Acts 2:42 tells us they continue to meet in the temple courts. Acts 5:12 tells us that they used to meet together in Solomon's colonnade within the temple courts, probably for corporate worship and teaching. And that's probably maybe 5 years later. So this is a consistent pattern. So gathering to meet and learn, worship and pray together was a consistent part of the life of the early church. But the second part of Acts 2:46 speaks, again translating literally, and breaking bread from house to house, they shared food in gladness and simplicity of heart. The large gatherings in the temple courts were supplemented and supported by smaller gatherings in homes. That means small group community was part of the church from the very beginning. It was part of this first wonderful church that was filled with God's presence and with awe and wonder. It is there from the very beginning. That more intimate place where we can have honest dialogue, where we can learn together and hold one another accountable, where we can pray and care for one another, where we can live out the faith together. That more intimate place, a small group community, is vital to our church being healthy, and it is there from the very, very beginning. I know it's hard to fit it into busy lives, yet I believe it's crucial. So crucial do I think it is that we have changed the whole way that we're doing business meetings as a church. We've done that to enable church leaders and staff members to be part of small groups rather than allowing their diaries to be filled with meetings. The old business maxim was that business expands to fill the time available. We are trying to constrict and contract the time we are giving to business meetings to allow much more time for discipleship, much more time for church life and connection between people. We're trying to do business meetings only on Mondays and at a pinch on Tuesdays, so that we have time and space to be part of a small group community and to commit to it as the leaders of the church. It's very easy for us to say that it's important, but if it's really important, how is it expressed in our lives? I've pushed for that because I believe it's vitally important to the life and health of our church. And please note that that's what we see in this picture in Acts 2 of the very first church. House-to-house meetings of small groups as part of a church that was utterly filled with God's presence and was amazingly fruitful for God in the world. We're going to be seeking to do small groups a bit differently in the autumn. We're going to try out some new ideas along the way. And that means it's a real opportunity right now, if you're not in a small group, to think and pray about it over the summer and maybe to start afresh in the autumn. It's a crucial way to belong. Really is. And it's critical to our desire, our stated desire to be a graceful community, a graceful community comprised of authentic disciples. Let me try and sum all of this up. We love because he first loved us. The fruit of his devotion, the fruit of Jesus' devotion, is that it is possible for us to know the Father. And we're called to respond in devotion ourselves, to make that response, that surrender, that pursuit kindled in us by the devotion with which Jesus sought us. Devotion has to shape our lives. It has to be expressed not just in words, but in practices, in disciplines, in commitments. Our devotion has to come to the point where it decisively shapes our lives, or our words of love mean nothing at all. I've suggested three ways in which we might shape our lives so that we can draw closer to Jesus. One practice is to keep the Sabbath as a way of fighting back against the intense, relentless busyness of our lives and our culture. Taking a day's holiday a week to rest, to recreate and to be restored. The second practice is to weave prayer into the fabric of our daily lives. Not all conversations with God have to be the same length, depth, and intensity, but prayer does need to be woven into our daily lives, to be timetabled into our busy schedules. Otherwise, in the end, whatever we say, there is no depth to our devotion to God. And the third practice to consider over the summer for a new beginning in the autumn is getting involved in a small group, getting involved in that place of greater warmth, involvement, and belonging. Jesus devoted his life to saving us. He devoted his life to making it possible for us to know the Father. We love because he first loved us. How is our devotion to Jesus shaping our lives? What kind of a response, surrender, pursuit is his devotion kindling in us? And how is that expressed in our lives? Amen.